You're listening to DraftKings Network.
Six months, 82 games, and finally, the postseason is here. First up, the SoFi NBA Play-In Tournament. For this, the rules are simple. Win to get in. Eight teams battle to earn their playoff spot in a win-or-go-home style tournament that is bound to be full of highlights, excitement, and drama. There's no better way to set the tone for the playoffs than this, so make sure you don't miss the action. Watch TNT's coverage of the SoFi NBA Play-In Tournament on April 16th and 19th on TNT, True TV, and Max.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Dan Le Batard Show with the Stugatz Podcast.
We usually do this with Ron McGill on Tuesdays, but today we are doing it on a special Wednesday edition, asking the animal questions. We've got a lot of them today, but one of them that came up the other day when we were talking about a hot air balloon that caught fire over the African plains and then landed in the African plains during my engagement trip to Africa. How much danger was I actually in, Ron? Not with the part of the balloon crashing, but just animals in the wild in Africa. What kind of danger was I landing in when the basket fell over sideways?
And less danger that you have walking across the street on Ocean Drive. Let's put it that way. Okay, the bottom line is this. Those animals, if that balloon came down, would all run away. Lions would run away. If you noticed, if you were flying over animals as you fly over them, they're running away. They're not used to something that large, that big. When it comes down, they're not going to come after you, Dan. You were never really in any danger.
Me? Other than Are you talking about me there or the balloon? That large, that big. You're talking about the balloon there, not me.
Well, yes, the initial largeness would be the balloon.
Ron, are wild animals aware of things like hot air balloons and planes and stuff like that that fly overhead?
They're definitely aware of them, and they become desensitized to them after a while. I mean, I know that still when you go in the plains, you know, I've been on balloon rides over the African plains many times, and I've not seen an animal that really is totally desensitized to it. They always look up, they always react, herds will run the other way. But yes, I mean, you can see listen, you can get an animal desensitized to almost anything. You can go to Busch Gardens and you'll see a roller coaster going loop to loop right next to the giraffe exhibit. And giraffes don't even look at it. It's a flipping roller coaster, just wah, 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 and the giraffe just eating their food so they don't pay attention because they become desensitized. So yes, animals do become desensitized to things.
Ron, how does the zoo handle mating? Is there a set schedule and what's the process that goes into that? Thank you, baby.
How do we handle mating? We don't handle it all. We let them handle it amongst themselves. They do it spontaneously. The more they do it, we assume that the more content they are. We put males and females together as to their genetic background. So we want to make sure we get the healthiest baby. We don't let just anybody screw. I mean, that's not the right thing to do. We want to make sure that we're having the right animals pair up together to produce the healthiest offspring with the best genetic pool behind them.
Right. That's why I was asking. Do you bring in animals from maybe other zoos for the right genetic matching?
Yeah, absolutely. We're part of a program called the SSP, the Species Survival Plan. And basically, to put it in very simplistic terms, it's like computer dating. Just like people who breed dogs, you know, you have a pedigree and your pedigree tells you which dog is the best dog to breed with which dog. Zoos have the same thing. There's one person for each species under the SSP. That person is called the stud bookkeeper. And that stud bookkeeper basically makes a decision as to which male should be with which female. Sometimes we'll fly a male of ours to be with a female, let's say at the Los Angeles Zoo. Sometimes if it's not practical to fly the animal, we'll actually collect the sperm and use it to artificially inseminate that animal. So you're still, you know, producing the same genetic makeup without the threat and danger of having to ship an animal back and forth.
Jessica, what do you have for Ron McGill?
Ron, I read that NASA is sending squids into space, and I'm curious, what exactly are researchers looking at when they send living organisms into space, and what might the squids look like when they return later this July?
That's a great question. I really don't know what they look like when they return. I think they're just looking at all kinds of things, whether it be, you know, the composition of their musculature, their blood counts, if there's any elevation in, let's say, white blood counts, red blood counts, you know, what kind of reaction the body is going through. I'm sure they have a series of tests done by scientists who are much smarter than I am to see what the differences are as opposed to a gravity, based environment, because I'm sure that makes a difference, as it does with human beings.
Jessica, what's the story I heard you guys talking about with the elephants before we started here? What was happening with elephants that lost their way?
Yeah, I don't know, Ron, if you read about this, but there was a group of elephants in China that wandered off course and ended up 300 miles away from their home. And I'm wondering what that means, just lost elephants. What happens when the elephants are lost?
Well, you know, there's so much development. There's so much human intrusion in so many areas. It's not that elephants may be lost. It just maybe they're looking for someplace to better survive. Elephants are incredibly intelligent animals, and they may be just searching for a better source of food, a better source of water as areas dry up, as there are droughts, as there are floods, whatever is affecting the environment. Elephants are very intelligent and will seek out better ways to survive. You know, it's just like, you know, I don't like always to equate people with animals, but, you know, sometimes if things are going bad in where you live, people migrate. They try to find a better place, a better living for their family.
It must make you mad when people are hunting elephants, no?
Yeah, it does make me mad, Dan. I wish people had the opportunity, as I've had, to see elephants in the wild, to look at an elephant face to face. When you look in the eyes of these animals, again, at the risk of sounding too overly, you know, bunny hugger, but there's a soul there. And when you see an animal frightened or you see an animal scared, you can see it in their eyes. I've seen it in elephant eyes. It's such a tragic thing. And to see how strong family bonds are with elephants, especially, I mean, you know, you've heard that term, it takes a village to raise a child. Elephants define that, because that's what elephants do. They're matriarchal. The elephant females raise all the calves in the herd. They're so protective. They will literally lay their lives down for their calves. So it's pretty distressing to think someone goes out there and hunts it for sport.
Tony, what do you have for McGill?
Ron, you're an extremely well-traveled man. We were having a conversation about what the most interesting and weird thing we've eaten. What's the weirdest thing you've eaten on your travels?
It would be a big maggot. It looks like a huge white maggot that's found in the heart of a tree in South America. And it was just horrible because I had to eat it alive. You put it in your mouth, you bite down, it squirts like a massive zit into your mouth. And it's wasn't very tasty, to say the least. But I always bring ketchups, packets of ketchup with me when I travel to those places, so I can try to make it more palatable. And that's what I use. I put the ketchup on it, and I made it a little easier.
You were being polite to some indigenous people, correct?
Yes, indigenous people. And, you know, that maggot is probably healthier for me than half of the food I buy out of a grocery store here. It's just, you know, mentally it plays minds on you. First of all, something moving in your mouth, it plays mind games with you. And then just the palatability, you know, it's just like the soft, gushy things that squirt in your mouth. That's not like a nice sweet taste. It's more like a salty, tangy taste. And the thing is still moving. It's not pleasant mentally. It's rough on the mind.
Was it like a savory gusher?
No, it wasn't at all, Jessica, like a savory gusher. It was like eating a big, ugly zit.
Oh, well, I would try a savory gusher, but I'm not sure about a big ugly
Why
zit.
Would you assume that a maggot of some sort, a giant maggot, would be a savory gusher? Did you not listen to anything he said before that?
He's describing something as squishy, though. Like
He said squishy, salty, like squirty, like mushy. I don't know.
Sounded like it.
Gusher.
There's nothing good about it. And the fact that it continues to move, even once you bite into it and it squirts in your mouth, is just disgusting.
Did you think about popping the maggot before putting it in your mouth?
No. That's the nutrition. You're supposed to get the nutrition. That pops into your mouth. It's like a gel cap, so to speak, with all the medicine inside.
Did
like
you politely gusher. Decline a couple of times, or did you try and extract yourself from the situation?
I never do that, Dan. I never decline eating whatever I'm offered, because it's just etiquette with indigenous people. You respect their beliefs, you respect their feeding, and they're doing it out of the goodness of their heart. They're trying to, you know, it's a privilege to be welcomed into their kind of circle that way.
What's the most interesting ritual you've been a part of?
Well, the most interesting ritual that I have seen, I've not been a part of it, thank God, is when the young boys in the Amazon, they go through this bridge to manhood. They're made to put on these gloves made out of palm fronds where they've got bullet ants attached to the glove. So when they put it on, these bullet ants are biting their hands and they're supposed to just kind of stay there without crying and screaming. I got hit by one bullet ant once in my life, and it called a bullet ant for a reason, because it feels like you got shot. And I'm looking at these kids that are probably 12, 13, 14 years old, holding there. You see the tears welling up in their eyes. You see the perspiration. You know the pain they're feeling. It's horrific. But that was just something I watched with just horror. It was horror.
Ron, after you had the maggot, did you eat something afterwards, or were you like prolonged period without eating something?
No, lots of ketchup packets.
That's all you had, though? You didn't have another meal after that to like fill yourself up?
They had a type of like a manioc. It's like a potato that I was able to kind of eat with that. And it's kind of making it into a porridge. It made it a little more palatable.
Ron, the Great Barrier Reef is going to be downgraded by the World Heritage status. What do you make of, and it's due to climate change, Australia plans to fight it. I presume all kinds of barrier reefs are suffering as a result. What do you make of that?
I don't like the fact that they're downgrading it, because it's taking, if anything, it needs to be upgraded in its critical status right now. This is one of the great wonders of the world. So much of it has already died off. It continues to die off. And people have to understand that reefs are the rainforests of the ocean. There is more life on these coral reefs than anyone can imagine. And as these reefs are dying, the oceans are slowly dying. And when people realize the amount of food, the amount of things that we get from the ocean for our own survival, it needs to be a huge red flag. So I would be, I don't like the term downgrading. I'd be upgrading all of that into such a critical status that people need to pay attention, because at the end of the day, it's going to affect our own quality of life.
What does that mean that it's being downgraded, just for people who don't know?
I think what they're saying is they're downgrading it from one of the great natural wonders of the world, because it's no longer one of the great natural wonders of the world, because it's lost so much of it to the death of its coral life. So, you know, it should be upgraded as to one of the big things that we need to be paying attention to and trying to protect.
Jessica, here's your opening.
It's just the Good Barrier Reef now.
McGill, the Amazon you mentioned, can you tell us what you have in terms of personal knowledge with the kanduru fish?
Okay, that's a myth, Dan. First of all, the kanduru fish is a fish that supposedly swims up the urethra of a penis if you're urinating in the water, okay, and has a dorsal fin spine that, once it gets locked up in there, locks up into the urethra and it can't come out, and you have to have surgery to split your penis open to take the kandura out, okay? This is a grossly exaggerated thing. I don't know if there have been some papers written about it, but there's never been like a documented photographed procedure where this has happened. Yes, there are certain parasites that will try to swim up warm fluids. So if you're urinating in the water, you create this warm fluid that might draw something to try to swim up in there, but it's been blown out of proportion with this spine coming out of the back of its back that locks up in the urethra. And now you have like a kidney stone in your freaking urethra with a spine of a fish that's wiggling, and you have this surgery. And then you start thinking, oh my God, now my penis is going to fall off. It's never going to work again. I got to get this gross thing that swam up there. That's very much exaggerated, Dan.
What are the greatest dangers of the Amazon?
Just things like, mosquito-borne diseases, blood-borne diseases. That's the most dangerous thing in the Amazon. Some of the, venomous plants, venomous snakes, of course. It's not jaguars. It's not anacondas. It's not piranhas. That's all BS. It's been blown out of proportion. The most dangerous things are the things you don't see as much. The diseases that can spread through, through mosquito-borne diseases, things like that. It's not the animals. So many people think, oh my God, I'm going to get killed by a jaguar. I'm going to get swallowed by an anaconda. I'm going to get attacked by a harpy eagle. Not true.
Skeptical Billy is.
No offense, Billy.
I went down to the Amazon. I did a documentary, and I brought Christy Krueger, one of our local anchors, with me down there. And we went in the Amazon, and we were fishing for piranha. As soon as I put the line in the water, man, I'm pulling piranha left and right. I mean, piranha, fighting, lots of piranha. As fast as we put the line in the water, and then when the camera was rolling, I freaked her out. I jumped off the boat into the water. They all thought I was going to get eaten, and I joked, "Oh!" And I looked at him and said, "Nothing's happening, guys. That's all a myth. That movie you see with a cow going down the river, and then the next scene is just the bones of floating down the river. That's a bunch of movie BS."
Oh, no, Ron. I've never heard of mosquito 3D, but I've seen piranha 3D.
Oh my God, what a bunch of BS that is. I've gone swimming and Christy jumped in afterwards. I made her jump in.
Oh, she didn't. Christy did not.
She did. Christy ran, and she will vouch for me that she jumped in where all those piranhas were and didn't get one single bite. So stop it. Stop proliferating that myth.
Ron, can't you just put on like a bunch of DEET and just go in the Amazon with some DEET?
Yeah, absolutely. If you're going into the Amazon with a bunch of DEET, that's going to help you out. But you asked me what the most dangerous thing was. Dangerous? What did he say? Yeet? Oh, my God.
That is Billy Gill in the chat with Yeet. We will let you go on that note. Thank you, Ron, for making an appearance. I don't think that he knew that you could see the chat. He thinks you're a he likes to bother you and
no.
He's you don't like
Dan, let me ask you a question. If I give you the option, jump in a tank full of piranha or walk through this, you know, outdoor air with mosquitoes, which you're going to choose?
That is correct, but he is more knowledgeable and he's actually done it, and you're calling him a liar.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. Thank you, Dan. And yeet to you, Billy. You all have a wonderful week.
6 months, 82 games, and finally, the postseason is here. First up, the SoFi NBA Play-In Tournament. For this, the rules are simple. Win to get in. 8 teams battle to earn their playoff spot in a win-or-go-home style tournament that is bound to be full of highlights, excitement, and drama. There's no better way to set the tone for the playoffs than this, so make sure you don't miss the action. Watch TNT's coverage of the SoFi NBA Play-In Tournament on April 16th and 19th on TNT, True TV, and Max.
This guy's been doing a lot of good work for a long time for Sports Illustrated and with his books. He's got a new one out, Glory Days, the Summer of 1984, and the 90 Days That Change Sports and Culture Forever. So tell us about those 90 days, why it is you decided to write about those 90 days. You choose subject matter when you're writing a book that you're going to invest years of your life in. So why did you choose these 90 days?
This originally started as a Sports Illustrated story on Michael Jordan and the 1984 Olympic trials that took place in my hometown in Bloomington, Indiana. And I didn't think you could quite do an entire book on the 84 Olympic basketball team, and it would have been too derivative of McCallum's book on the Dream Team. But the more I poked around, I was like, you know, an incredible amount of really significant, memorable, prominent for decades sports events took place that summer. And it struck me that Jordan was a pretty good metaphor, who people forget started that summer reluctant to even go pro. He wanted to go back to UNC. Dean Smith essentially made him go to the NBA. He's sort of the schlubby college kid. And by the end of the summer, he has a gold medal. He's a lottery pick. He has his own signature shoe deal. And in the span of a few months, he was completely transformed. And the device of the book is this was a bigger, the sort of mirrored sports more generally. And you could say the same thing about sports. It started the summer in one place and ended somewhere very different.
What else was in the story? Michael Jordan is the catapult, right? Because we turn him through the mythologizing of commercialization, of him sitting out a lot of conversations. We turned him into somebody who was just sports hero excellence personified. And are you talking about Spike Lee and where the commercialization of Michael Jordan began? What was happening in those specific 90 days to Jordan?
First of all, the word was out of just how good he was. I mean, Bob Knight was saying on record, you know, Michael Jordan is the best basketball player on the planet right now. I don't mean potentially. I don't mean down the road when he can compete with Magic and Larry Bird. Right now. And that was before he played his first NBA game. Meanwhile, David Falk is saying, you know what, enough of signing these guys to a shoe deal and throwing them on a poster and giving them a couple of shekels to wear their Converse. We're going to really turn this guy into a brand. And that hadn't really been done in team sports before. And then, you know, that same summer, as Jordan was, again, before he's played the first game for the Chicago Bulls, it is completely sort of reforming himself and reinventing himself. While that's happening, Bird and Magic are playing in game 7 of the NBA Finals for the first time. Wayne Gretzky wins his first Stanley Cup. The NBA has a new commissioner, this guy, David Stern, who one of his big goals is to see if the NBA could transcend borders and actually move beyond the U.S. The you know, ESPN was sold to ABC. You had the Supreme Court case that said, you know what, maybe college football teams can negotiate their own football contracts. And that sort of is at the heart of the legislation and the cases that's going on now. You had a profitable Olympics. You had this guy, Vince McMahon, say, you know what, I'm going to get all these territories of wrestling and I'm going to streamline them into one organization. And we're going to hold one event that crosses over and uses cable TV. And that ended up being the birth of WrestleMania. All this was happening sort of week by week by week. Same in pop culture. You know, Purple Rain comes out one week and Ghostbusters comes out the next week and Born in the USA comes out the week after that. And it did. I think you and I are about the same age. I mean, I was in, I guess, sixth, seventh grade, and it seemed like a pretty cool summer. And you liked Karate Kid and everybody loved the Olympics and you ate free Big Macs when Americans won gold. But it didn't seem like this transformative summer. It didn't seem, you know, it wasn't like the summer of 68 is described. But you look back and you just say, holy cow, so much was crammed into this event that still has resonance, whatever, 37 years later.
What you're really talking about here, though, is sort of pinpointing a three-month period where sports became what we know it to now be as business, right? You're saying ESPN media giant. You're saying college football becoming television programming. You're saying, mm-hmm. You're identifying the things that made sports giant business the next four decades afterward.
Absolutely. I mean, that's exactly right. And I started out with, oh, there's a series of coincidences. And then it was sort of like, okay, well, what is it, just coincidences? Is it just this amazing concentration of events that we all remember, or is there something else? And I think the big something else were cable TV. I mean, this was really the summer of cable, and MTV started turning a profit and CNN started turning a profit and ESPN was sold and sort of very cleverly said, you know what, instead of paying these cable systems to be on their options of channels, you know what, they should be paying us. Who wants to get cable if you can't get ESPN? We're going to charge them a subscriber fee, which seemed radical at the time, but was the secret sauce that led ESPN to be what it is. And guys like David Stern and Vince McMahon and Peter Ueberroth, they saw that coming. They saw what cable was going to do to sports. And you also had, I mean, again, I think he's real. I mean, one thing I took away from this book, David Falk has probably gotten a short shrift by history, because what he did with Jordan and the way he approached it and the way he negotiated with Nike and the way he said, you know, the Bulls can pay Michael Jordan whatever they're going to pay him, but he ought to be making 10 times that when he's not playing basketball. It sounds crazy now, but that really hadn't been done. I mean, it used to be, you know, again, hey, Magic, wear these Converse shoes and we may spend a day of your summer shooting a commercial. What David Falk did for Jordan was completely transformative. And here, it's exactly what you said. I mean, here we are. And these are the origins of modern sports as we know it.
It was almost quaint once upon a time that the Lakers would bestow upon Magic Johnson a 25-year, $25 million contract. It was all the money in the world. Was Michael Jordan more important to Nike, or was Nike more important to Michael Jordan?
That is a great question. That is a book in itself right there. Michael Jordan rookie contract, by the way, I think it was $565,000. But no, I mean, you look at where they were obviously the easy answer is they were great together and they did right by each other. I mean, look at what the Jordan brand is worth today. Look at what Jordan did for Nike in the mid to late 80s, not just in terms of sales, but they had the global athlete. I mean, they had the man in sports. And look how they rode that. Look at Nike's revenues from the summer of 84 when they signed Jordan. They do this whole presentation. They get a designer who's flying back from D.C. where Jordan's agent was, and he sees a kid next to him on the plane with a pair of wings and decides to make an Air Jordan logo with those wings. Look at what happens to Nike from, say, summer of 84, fall of 84, when Jordan finally starts playing and is as good as advertised for the Bulls, and project that out for 10 years. And whatever Jordan was getting from Nike probably was a fraction of what he earned that company.
Nike and ESPN combined, correct? The explosion of both of those things, sneaker company commercialization, monetization combined with media giant becoming sports empire and needing to fill the mill. What else was contributing in the time of MTV toward Michael Jordan? It's a big bang, correct?
Yep, exactly. And I think, you know, with that, but when you saw how much money Michael Jordan could make and how he could structure a deal, I mean, Michael Jordan had a bonus clause where if the Bulls, who before he got to the team were drawing less than 50% capacity, he got an attendance bonus clause. I think a lot of athletes woke up not just to ways you could cleverly frame a contract, which, you know, not every athlete has the leverage or the pull of Michael Jordan to do that. But I think there was this awakening, not in terms of political activism and platform that we usually talk about with athletes, but economics and power. I mean, Michael Jordan, this is one of my favorite stories. Michael Jordan did not go to the 84 draft, right? You have this new commissioner. He's got this thick mustache. He's riding this hot hand. This guy, David Stern, he's just sat courtside as the Lakers beat the Celtics. Game 7, first time Bird and Magic play in a final. So David Stern, he's on a hot streak. And he says, you know what? In a few days from now, we got this draft coming up. We're going to make it a thing. The draft used to just be a bunch of guys in a hotel ballroom. We're going to televise this. We're going to pay the USA Network, one of these new cable outfits, to broadcast it. We want all the players to come. And Michael Jordan didn't go to the draft that year. Why was that? Because Bob Knight, the Olympic coach, wouldn't let him leave Indiana and spend a day in Manhattan. You know, Knight said, I don't want him to get his ass kissed by a bunch of suits in New York. So Michael Jordan is the third pick in the draft that year, and he celebrates by going out for a Big Mac with George Raveling at a McDonald's in Bloomington, Indiana. I mean, that's how he spent draft night. And I think, you know, you hear that story, and it's kind of quaint, and I have a bunch of stories that are personal in the book, how we used to go watch this team practice, and they didn't even lock the doors of the gym. I mean, anyone off the street could have walked in and watched Jordan, Barkley, Ewing, Chris Mullin, and John Stockton practice that summer. It just wasn't a thing. And it's quaint, and it's sort of, you know, it's nostalgia. But I think what it also says is these athletes had zero power, and these athletes didn't recognize their worth. They didn't recognize their financial worth. And I think one thing that we sort of gloss over in the Jordan Nike signature shoe retelling is the immense amount of power that swung back to the athletes. I mean, the fact that Jordan was making 10, 20 times as much from Nike and from bonuses as he was from what, you know, Rod Thorne and the Bulls were paying him, I think is something we don't talk about enough, because it really, I think, is this big demarcation point in athletes and agents realizing what labor is worth.
The name of the book is Glory Days, the Summer of 84 and the 90 Days That Changed Sports and Culture Forever. He also is an executive editor and senior writer at Sports Illustrated, and just wanted, so people don't actually have to go and read the things that you have reported and given expertise on, I'd like some Cliff Notes versions on some of the things you've written recently. So why are influencers taking over boxing here? How is this happening? And is it a good thing that this is happening?
The jury is out on that. This was pre-Mayweather fight, I'll have you know. But I'm one of these people. I don't know if you're the same way. I'm 100% in, you know, I'll pay any PPV for MMA. I mean, I'll watch every USC card. Boxing has completely lost me, and I think a lot of people are in that same boat. And this is sort of a shot in the arm for boxing to have these influencers fight. And most people can't name the heavyweight champ, but they know the Paul brothers. And so this sort of is an examination of that. And is this going to save boxing, or is this going to completely distort this sport into anyone with a social media following that can lace up gloves, can get a fight?
Is this why you were lured to the story of the MMA fighter who punched back, the story you wrote about police killing George Floyd? What was the starting point on that story?
It's funny, I did a book like 10 years ago. I got assigned to do this story for Sports Illustrated. I knew nothing. I mean, I didn't know if it was live or fake or real. I mean, I knew nothing about MMA, and did a story about 10 years ago for Sports Illustrated and got completely hooked, and ended up doing a book on MMA. And I spent time at a gym in the Quad Cities. And one of the managers there tipped me off that one of the George Floyd witnesses was an MMA fighter who wasn't, you know, he wasn't a UFC level fighter, but he was taking pro fights, and he was sort of fighting in and around the Midwest. And then I sort of followed it a little bit, and then I watched him testify, and it was, I don't know if you remember, I mean, it was really powerful stuff. And he was this MMA fighter who said, look, I'm standing there. I understand what these chokes are all about. I understand how inappropriate this is. I'm also a guy with, you know, I've got a girlfriend, I've got kids. I can't just jump in. And he was paralyzed, and he spoke at the trial really movingly about that. He understood completely what this choke was, how inappropriate it was, and yet he felt frozen. And when I saw him testify, I was like, I got to get in touch with this guy and tell the story. And he was really, I thought, really poignant, telling that when he prepared for this trial, he looked at it as if he were preparing for a fight. And he stood in front of the mirror, and he thought about potential pitfalls, and he strategized, and he even sort of did push-ups and sit-ups to work off his nervous energy. And he ended up giving some of the most compelling testimony, I thought, at that George Floyd trial. And now he's trying to figure out, is he ready to channel that back into fighting and go back to trying to be an MMA fighter? Or is he so horrified by seeing a choke misused? And is he sort of so damaged by what he saw that he's now turning against violence? And he's kind of wrestling with that right now.
You've written a lot about tennis over the years. What made you explore recently the parent as coach dynamic? Because it's something that's been present the entire time you've been interested in tennis.
Yeah, I mean, you really only have this in individual sports, right? I mean, the notion of an NBA parent being intimately involved with the career of a 22-year-old is silly. And yet in tennis, you have that. And some of it's financial, right? You can save, you don't have to pay a coach when dad is sitting there. And in some cases, the Williams sisters being the most obvious, it actually is really successful. And these parents know what buttons to push and they know how to motivate their kid and they can say things that a coach can't. In other cases, it's disastrous. And in a recent case, you know, a female in South Florida, Pembroke Pines, Sonia Kennan, a young American who actually won the Australian Open last year, she recently parted ways with her father. And it was one of these cases where, you know, it probably wasn't a healthy relationship. And it took a lot of courage for her to push dad out and say, you know, time for me to fly solo here.
That world is so parental, all of it, culturally. It's not just coaches. It's just the whole thing. The thing that happened with Osaka felt parental to me, as if the lording body it gets to be your father and your mother. Because and the kids tend to be, I don't know, used to it, I guess I would say, used to being parented. It doesn't seem like they're as grown-ups in some ways as the other athletes because of the coddling of the ecosystem. Am I wrong about this? You know it more than I do.
No, you are 100% right. And you have these dueling forces where it's really stressful and it's an individual sport and it's real combat and it requires mental toughness. And yet everyone's kind of their own company. There's no, you know, there's no union. I mean, there's no one running ship. It's a very strange relationship with a coach where, you know, they're the coach. They're in theory telling you what to do, but you're paying them, right? I mean, it's as if Steph Curry were paying Steve Kerr. I mean, it's a strange dynamic with an outside coach and there's a distrust, you know, the other player on the other side of the net. Yeah, it's a colleague, but they're also trying to beat you. And you're traveling all over the world, so you have that. You're away. You know, if you don't go, not like your parents can just pop over and go to the game or watch you. You know, Del Curry can fly to the Bay Area and keep getting Airbnb for a while. You can't do that when your kid's going from Tokyo to Shanghai to Dubai. And so you put it all together, and you have these very strange relationships. And you're right. There is a real sort of mix of fierce independence. So Naomi Osaka releases that. She didn't confer with anyone. She didn't have to run that by PR. I mean, she's completely free to do that on her own. But then once she did, there was this really parental, paternalistic response where all these bodies sort of cracked down on her. So it's the dynamic. I tell you, it's one reason I love the sport. I mean, it's great to cover. I mean, it makes for good storytelling. But it's a really fraught environment for a lot of reasons. But yeah, what you just hit on is absolutely correct. It's a sort of weird mix of fierce independence. I can play whenever I want. And if I want to quit a tournament, I quit a tournament. But you combine that with the fact that between the tours and the tournaments and the coaches and the parents, the players have all the power in the world and they have very little power.
John, appreciate the time, sir. Thank you for the work you do.
You got it. Congrats. I feel like I'm seeing your new home, and it's you. The risk of dry. You are a role model. It's great what you've done. Seriously.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.